In the last talk, I sketched out the development of the bourgeois democratic revolutions and the parliamentary democracies they created or failed to create from the 16th to the 19th centuries. Today, I would like to trace the progress of democratic ideas in our own country. I stress the term ideas because I don't propose to go into the details of the events of the political movements which brought democracy into this country. This is rather a talk on the democratic creed, which is the popular religion of the United States. Our national philosophy today is pragmatism, and along with it, romantic and idealized democracy is the secular American religion. This is what Americans really believe in their most exalted ideas. This is not simply my observation. It will be found in a book by Professor Ralph Gabriel on the course of American thought. And here's what Professor Gabriel says. Romantic democracy consisted of a cluster of ideas and ideals that, taken together, made up a national faith, which, although unrecognized as such, had the power of a state religion. So what I'm going to talk about is how the unofficial state religion of the American people came into being and fastened its hold upon the American mind and imagination. The sources of the bourgeois democratic ideology, which is the intellectual generalization in political terms of the basic conditions and demands of the bourgeois democratic social movement, are four. I'll merely refer to them, I won't go into them. One is Christianity, especially in its Protestant form. The second is the ideas of the English Revolution from 1640 to 1680. In the radical form of the ideas of the Levellers, which I spoke about yesterday, and the conceptions of John Locke, who was the philosopher of the triumphant or conservatized bourgeois revolution. The fourth source of our democratic creed is the French Enlightenment and the French Revolution, as these ideas found fruition in the Declaration of the Rights of Man, the fundamental document of the French Revolution. But far more decisive than these intellectual borrowings from overseas in forming and sustaining our democratic ideology have been the conditions of life and labor in the United States from colonial days to the present. And I want to say something about the interplay between the basic conditions of our social life and the general conceptions which Americans have about the nature of their society and their political setup. In a talk I gave at the beginning of our program, I stated that American society, as distinguished from all others of the great powers of the world, has been based from its very foundations upon bourgeois relations. Our bourgeois democratic ideas had their material roots in capitalist relations, and they have sprouted and thrived wherever these economic conditions have taken hold and spread. In his famous work on capital, Marx explained the organic linkage between capitalist economy and the democratic ideology of the bourgeois type. Here's how Marx's reasoning went. He pointed out that the surplus value accruing to the capitalist class, that is, the basis of its profits, originates from the buying of labor power for wages on the market. And then he goes on to say the following. The sphere within whose confines the purchase and sale of labor power are effected is in fact a paradise of the rights of man. Here liberty, equality, property, and Jeremy Bentham are supreme. Liberty, because the buyer and seller of a commodity, such as labor power, buy and sell at their own sweet will. They enter into bargains as free individuals, equals before the law. The contract between them is the final outcome of the expression of their joint wills. Equality, because they enter into relations only as owners of commodities and exchange equivalent for equivalent. Property, because each of them disposes exclusively of his own. Jeremy Bentham, because each of the pair is only concerned with his own interest. I might explain parenthetically that Bentham was the champion of the utilitarian school, whose basic doctrine was that social harmony and progress come out of each man following his personal interest, which you will recognize as a good part of the American creed. To continue with Marx, the power which brings them together, which makes them enter into relation one with another, is self-interest and nothing more. Every one for himself alone, no one with any concern for another. Thanks to this, owing to the pre-established harmony of things, or under the auspices of an all-wise providence, they work together for their mutual advantage, for the common weal, on behalf of the common interest of them all. So far, Karl Marx. The political categories of capitalist democracy, such as liberty, equality, free enterprise, are in substance the generalized expression of these basic economic elements of capitalist property and exploitation. The two go hand in hand in the ascending period of capitalist society. Now that I've shown you the economic roots of democracy, let us go on to analyze the mainstream of our national thought since the 18th century, which has been constituted by this kind of ideology. There have been three main stages in the evolution of bourgeois democratic thought in our country, which I propose to deal with in summary outline. The democratic creed first blossomed on American soil during the 18th century in what is known as the Enlightenment, which attended the first American Revolution. It became revitalized in the fountain of transcendentalism, which was fed by the springs of social conflict, which later erupted in the Civil War. The third incarnation of bourgeois democratic ideology was the pragmatic school, culminating in the instrumentalism of John Dewey. These are the three successive phases or schools of bourgeois democratic thought in the United States. Let us now take up the first of these. Religious, philosophical, and political radicalism went together in the making of our democratic tradition. You will recall that I pointed out the first demands for democratic reforms connected with the bourgeois revolutionary movement were for changes in the sphere of religion, for reforms in ecclesiastical organization and customs. And so it was on a higher level with the progressive schools of thought in American life. Karl Marx said, the beginning of all criticism is the criticism of religion. And that was the case in our own country as well. Only the religion which was criticized in our early days was not Catholicism, but Protestantism in one or another of its conservatized sects. The earliest efforts of American thought to escape from clerical bondage, which had philosophy as its handmaiden in the very early colonial days, were associated with the rise of the rationalist remodeling of religion in the form of what is called deism in the 18th century. I don't know how many of you know what deism is, but in its day, it was quite a radical innovation in Protestant thinking. It helped prepare the minds of men for the first American Revolution. Deism is the conception that God does not interfere in everyday life in a miraculous manner. He operates like a good machinist or a watchmaker. That is to say, he creates the universe, he sets it into motion, and then it runs according to its own law. Now, this has two sides. In the first place, it puts God into retirement, so to speak, so far as the normal operations of the universe and of society is concerned. It's a half step towards the relegation of religion into the background. On the other hand, and this was its positive attraction to the believers, if you view the perfection of operation and the laws of operation of the external world, you will see the handiwork and the wonders of God. Some of the foremost leaders of the first American Revolution were children of this age of enlightenment, deists or theists. They were, for the most part, non-churchgoers, although this is not stressed in the college courses on early American history. They adhered to what is known as natural religion, whose kernels were the Newtonian world system, the writings of John Locke, and the teachings of the French Enlightenists. Their criticisms of the official authorities in the religious realm trained them for contests with the civil authorities of the established order. There were two types of religious institutions they bucked up against. The most important were the Anglicans. The Anglicans were royalists because the Anglican was the official church of the king, both in England and in the colonies. And then, again, they went up against the Calvinist theocrats of New England. That is to say, the more conservative guardians of the established order. The religious unorthodoxies of these rebels was inseparable from their politics and their philosophy. Ethan Allen, Tom Paine, Jefferson, Franklin, and even Washington, who was the richest man in the colonies, turned away from orthodox systems of faith as well as against the authority of the British Crown. Moreover, it's easy to see why they did so or had to do so. The divine right of kings and the fusion of church and state were directly challenged by our colonial revolutionary movement. And no one more conspicuously expressed this than the man who carried everything to extremes in the first American Revolution. You know his name. It was the Republican Tom Paine. I might say that at that time, Republican was the equivalent of Bolshevik. As you know, become something quite different in our own day. And that's why Paine is so titanic a figure in the preparation and consummation of our democratic revolution, and why, as a matter of fact, today he is not even given proper credit for what he did. Tom Paine took the doctrine of divine rights and he turned it upside down. Instead of attributing celestial virtues and powers to the English monarch, he said it had a devilish origin. Just as today, you will find the most militant elements among the Negro people calling Christianity the white man's religion, the spawn of the devil, and counterposing a different viewpoint in its stead. Well, Tom Paine essentially did the same thing. Here's what he told the colonists in his famous pamphlet, Common Sense. In the early ages of the world, according to scripture, there were no kings. Government by kings was first introduced in the world by heathens, from whom the children of Israel copied the custom. It was the most prosperous invention the devil ever set on foot for the promotion of idolatry. So, you see how political and religious heresy accompanied each other, and how in a revolutionary situation, the old values become turned upside down and inside out. The most iconoclastic form of this rationalism inclined to pass over into materialism, but as yet, such extreme tendencies were not strong or very influential. So much for the first school of democratic thought. The next big push in democratic ideology was inspired by the ferment of new ideas among the most progressive thinkers in the northern states in the decades before the Civil War. As a body of thinkers, they have been called transcendentalists. Their headquarters were in New England. I won't go into the more theoretical side of their doctrines, because if you're not a specialist in the field of philosophy, they don't matter very much. I want rather to talk about their practical and historical starting point, which is more significant. This came from the frustrations felt by the forward-looking middle-class and plebeian elements in the North in the years of political reaction before the Civil War. You may think you're the only people who ever lived through decades of political reaction as revolutionists or as radicals. It would be a very instructive experience for some of you to read, especially the intimate writings and the letters of the abolitionists in the 1830s, 1840s, and 1850s. They didn't feel as though they were a conquering army, although they were fervently persuaded of the rightness, even the divine support accorded their mission. No, they felt like a handful of people who were beleaguered and fighting against almost overwhelming hosts. Despite the fortitude they showed, carrying on a small minority movement, their objectives at times seemed hopeless to them. They felt that the society around them was so apathetic, so inert, that it couldn't be easily and immediately be shaken up or turned upside down. The writers and preachers who shared these moods were repelled by the ugly features of the dominant slaveholder capitalist regime. But they couldn't clearly see any practical way of throwing off the power structure. In this respect, they differed from the ideologists of the Patriot Party, many of whom were forefathers of these very people. You take Wendell Phillips. His grandfathers had participated in the Revolution. The Patriot leaders in the preceding century relied upon enlightened reason. They looked outward and came to grips directly with the hostile authorities around them and above them. Because of their cramped situation, the transcendentalists acted and thought somewhat differently. They turned inward upon themselves and away from their social environment. They came to rely upon intuition, that is to say, an inner light, rather than reason, analyzing the evidences of experience. They said they wanted to get to the oversoul, the spiritual reality which was hidden behind the veil of appearances. Well, if you take this spiritual reality, this oversoul they talked about so much, and you analyze it the way a chemist analyzes an unknown compound, what do you find that its substance was composed of? The ideal realm they sought, they aspired, and looked forward to was the depository of the cherished values denied them by the workaday bourgeois world around them, which was overshadowed nationally by the slave power. So it was that they didn't have a rationalist and empirical outlook, as our patriot forefathers did, but rather an idealistic outlook. They felt that anyone who was materialistic or too practical was an apologist for slothful ease and for skepticism. They wanted positive beliefs leading to positive reforms. And so the transcendentalists, they're so called because they believed in absolute truth, absolute justice, absolute good. That was the charter for an uncompromising attitude. They weren't content with half measures. They wanted all or nothing at all. And they took these conceptions, which they thought were derived from direct communication with God or with nature, and wielded them as weapons against acquiescence in the status quo. Now, for those students of social ideology, this is very instructive. If you want to derive a lesson from human thought in general and American thought in particular, it demonstrates how, under certain circumstances, even the most idealistic conceptions can play a progressive and even a revolutionary role, even if they're illusory and incorrect. Because what is important is not the inner substance of these ideas, but the forces that use them and the way in which they use them and the forces against which they use them. And that's why, for example, at certain times, even religious ideas, which are totally fictitious, have had a revolutionary use and effect. What this means is not that you shouldn't distinguish between true and false ideas, but when you're studying ideas, you shouldn't consider them just in and of themselves. You must always see ideas in their social context and in their social function. In this connection, I'd like to read to you a paragraph from another historian of American thought. This is from The Development of American Philosophy by two scholars, one by the name of Lerner and the other named Sears. Here's what they wrote about the transcendentalists. The transcendentalists thought of themselves as revolutionists. They set out to make all things new. There is not a significant figure among them who was not at one time or another involved in subversive activities. Did they tell you at school, when you studied Emerson, Alcott, Hawthorne, and all the others, that at one time or another they were involved in the subversive activities of their time? but it happens to be a fact. Samuel May was mobbed 5 times within 1 month for preaching abolition. I'm still quoting these scholars. Thoreau went to prison rather than pay a tax to the state, which countenanced slavery and followed this protest with his duty of civil disobedience. Theodore Parker was indicted for obstructing the fugitive slave law, which he had most certainly done. Parker was a Boston minister. Alcott hit a Negro who passed through Concord on the Underground Railway. Even the aloof Emerson went home with a copy of the fugitive slave law stuck in his pocket to sit down before his journal and write, "I will not obey it, by God." So much for those who tell us nowadays that the highest duty of people is to obey unjust laws and to submit to an unjust social order. The best people in America before the Civil War didn't and couldn't do it. I'd like to read to you something that Theodore Parker wrote when he reviewed Emerson's writings in March 1850. That is over 100 years ago. And it's good to recall these utterances of an earlier time because they give moral reinforcement to those of us who are struggling in similar apathetic surroundings nowadays. Here's what Parker wrote about the social surroundings that the transcendentalists were recoiling against. You see, Emerson lives in a land with free institutions, with town meetings and ballot boxes, in the vicinity of a decaying church, amongst men whose terrible devils are poverty and social neglect, the only devils whose damnation is much cared for. Emerson does not worship the idols of our time, wealth and respectability. He fears not the damnation of those idols which have the power to inflict neither poverty nor social disgrace. He is against commercial Boston, where honor is weighted in the public scales and justice reckoned by the dollars it brings. Conservative Boston, the grave of the revolution, wallowing in its wealth, yet groveling for more, seeking only money, careless of justice, stuffed with cotton, yet hungry with tariffs, sick with the world of avarice, loving money as the end of life and bigotry as the means of preserving it. Boston, with Toryism in the parlors, Toryism in its pulpits, Toryism in its press, itself a Tory town, preferring the accidents of man to man himself. Well, you can see that this Theodore Parker was quite a preaching fellow. And that's the kind of stuff that he fed his congregation. Now, the radical tendencies of the movements associated with the transcendentalists were certified by one undeniable kind of evidence. That was the hostility they aroused among the protectors of the established order, who know their own opponents very well. The alarmed Orthodox churches united with the colleges to scotch these heretics and reformers. The transcendentalists were denounced as damnable, and so were all their doctrines. They agitated for women's rights, for the extension of the vote, and above all for anti-slavery, which leaned for support upon all the other heresies. And so men like Emerson, Thoreau, Theodore Parker were castigated from the pulpit, the press, and the colleges, and excluded from the seats of the mighty. It was only after the Civil War that they became canonized and enshrined as saints of American thought. Now I want to retrace my steps a little bit. I've said that the substance of the social and political theory needed by the American people was supplied by the English and French ideologists of the bourgeois democratic revolution. Our founding fathers quickly accepted and assimilated these doctrines and reshaped them for their own ends. They weren't nationalist-minded. They couldn't be entirely, because after all, most of what they had that was valuable came from overseas, including ideas of revolutionary thought and action. They looked to Europe for suggestions on how to solve the problems of their own developing revolution. Grabbed hold of them, improved and advanced them. So many people think that these ideas, which originated in France and England, are Native American growths, whereas they were really transplanted into this environment and, like many transplantations, improved in the process. In order to have creative thought stimulated, you need sharp oppositions in the lives of the people, which give birth to very tense conflict. The preparatory struggles before the launching of the first American Revolution called forth such intense activity in social thought and political theory. If you will read the major popular document of the time, Common Sense, it is full of highly dialectical observations. I use the word dialectical to denote a revaluation of values, turning things upside down and inside out, as the social political movement was doing. Here's what Tom Paine told the Patriots in 1775. He proclaimed that it was time for the weapons of criticism to be replaced by the criticism of weapons. Here's what he wrote. By referring the matter from argument to arms, a new era of politics has struck. A new method of thinking has arisen. All plans, proposals, and so on, prior to the 19th of April, that is the Battle of Concord and Lexington, are like the almanacs of last year. They were proper then, but superseded and useless now. When you can write revolutionary dialectical ideas like that, you're worth your weight in gold to a progressive movement. Now, Paine referred to a new method of thinking, which events had brought to the fore. What was it? It was the ideology of the bourgeois democratic revolution, which now had to be rigorously applied in practice. The point I want to emphasize, and that's why I have returned to it twice in my talk, is this. The basic ideas of all subsequent bourgeois schools of thought, or middle-class schools of thought, or reformist schools of thought, or liberalistic schools of thought in the United States were laid down during this period. This was the pioneering days of American thought. It is from this point onward that the conceptions of bourgeois democracy became the standard and the standardized forms of thought in American life. They became the ruling ideas. So dominant, in fact, that they were appealed to not only by those who governed this country, but by those who were governed by them. The victories and achievements of the first American Revolution in the 18th century and then its successor in the 19th century tightened the grip of this ideology upon the minds of the American people so that it's going to take explosives almost of a nuclear character to blast them out. And this brings us to the third great stage of bourgeois democratic thought. You know that as the school of pragmatism. Pragmatism is one of the latest offshoots of the bourgeois democratic ideology. And the historical roots of its principal ideas are to be found in the bourgeois democratic movement of the Western world. Its political program harks back to the ideals voiced by the Declaration of Independence, and its political theory does not pass beyond the general rights of man demanded by the middle-class democracy, with, of course, whatever amendments they think necessary for adaptation to modern capitalist life. The revolutionary period of the 18th century was the creative springtime of bourgeois thought in America. After independence had been won, the republic constituted, and social stability gained, or rather regained, radical thought itself grew stabilized and conventional. The formerly fluid patterns of democratic ideology became stereotyped so that any 4th of July orator could take a series of pat phrases, deliver them, and get the customary applause. Meanwhile, the young nation prospered. Whatever enemies were met with in the territorial expansion to the Pacific, all the way from the Mexicans to the Indians, were crushed. The economy moved forward after every halt. Throughout the 19th century, the democratic ideology inherited from the Revolution sufficed to answer the most serious problems confronting the progressive forces. And this was demonstrated when they came into the collision with the most formidable of internal obstacles, the slave power. I'd like to say something about that, because it was a very important episode in the development and reinforcement of the bourgeois democratic ideology. From the very beginning of our nation, the slave power had stood in flagrant contradiction to the democratic creed. That's obvious. How does slavery conform to the glorious declarations in the Declaration of Independence? However, that contradiction remained embedded in the very foundations of American society until the open counter-revolution of the slaveocracy in 1861. Now, from an ideological standpoint, what is most important is the fact that this struggle called for the defense of democratic institutions and the reaffirmation of the ideas of bourgeois democracy, not for their replacement by a new economic system or by a new set of ideas. And so it was that the defeat of the Confederacy in the Civil War awarded a total monopoly to the democratic doctrines in their bourgeois form. Who could doubt that they were the only possible creed after they had proved their superiority in severe competition, their invincibility in war, their truth in national life, not to speak of their usefulness in the state papers and the orations of the capitalist politicians? In politics, as well as in other fields, Nothing is so convincing as success. What is unbeaten in practice appears equally unbeatable in theory, except to a small handful of very perspicacious people who represent the future and see farther into it. The total triumph of the bourgeois democratic forces made it impossible for other views to find a firm foothold or get a hearing from large masses. And then the social situation after the Civil War favored a remodeling of the old system of thought rather than the search for a radical new foundation to philosophy. During the period between the end of the Civil War and the beginning of the First World War, a new trend in philosophy, connected with the populist and the progressive movements, which aspired not to get rid of capitalism, but rather to revise it in a democratic direction, came to the fore. This was pragmatism. Pragmatism was the philosophical expression of left liberalism, of middle-class progressivism, and its foremost representative was John Dewey. The heart of his whole philosophy, its meaning and purpose, is his theory of democracy. And the last point in my review of democratic thought in this country is to analyze the essential points of Dewey's theory of democracy, his political philosophy, which is shared by almost all progressive Americans who are not Marxists. Dewey put forward the notion of a classless democracy. His conception of what democracy is crowns his pluralistic theory of society and his public service notion of the state. He didn't believe that economic conditions and class relations determine political phenomena. And he didn't approach democracy the way we do, as an historically produced and materially conditioned mode of government. He was the champion of a pure democracy, which never was on land or on sea. Here's what he wrote in a book summarizing his thought. The keynote of democracy is the necessity for the participation of every human being in formulation of the values that regulate the living of men together. All those who are affected by social institutions must have a share in producing and managing them. There's nothing wrong with this, as the definition of what an ideal democracy should be. But Dewey is here painting the portrait of an ideal democracy, not the features of any real one that has so far existed on this planet. None of the political democracies from ancient Greece to modern America have met or do meet these specifications. They have all been based upon relations of exploitation, have harbored within themselves rich and poor, and have restricted, sometimes very severely, the participation and control of its people in public affairs. The Greek city-state republics were rooted in slavery, denied political rights to foreigners, slaves, and women, and were dominated by aristocrats and plutocrats. The democracies of the bourgeois era have been economically established on private property and the exploitation of wage labor by the capitalists. Their politics have been formulated and executed by representatives of the wealthy classes. Many categories of citizens, including workers, women, Negroes, and younger people, have been disfranchised by various means. And even where they could vote, the power apparently vested in the people was actually exercised by the strongest and most solid section of the ruling class. American democracy, for example, about which Dewey was speaking, has coexisted with chattel slavery, with wage slavery, and with ruthless imperialist oppression. However, Dewey believed that while all this may have been true of the past and of other times and other countries, and even to a certain extent within our own country, such perversions of democracy need no longer exist in the United States. Here, all the conditions had ripened for the creation of an unrestricted and classless democracy. What stood in the way of its realization? Only tradition, lack of scientific method, and inadequate education. You see that these are rather etherealized and ideological forces. However, something much more substantial than ignorance blocks the expansion of democracy for the American people. And that's the social, economic, political, and military supremacy of the monopoly capitalists. This power elite, as the left liberal sociologists characterize them, has no permanent attachment to democracy. They will tolerate the forms of democracy so long as these can be manipulated to their advantage, and so long as the workers do not seriously challenge their rulership in society. But they will not hesitate to reduce and even discard such forms and turn to one or another type of dictatorship when the present system of government runs into a blind alley and they fear the loss of their privileged positions. The dollar democracy of the United States, based upon the revolutionary achievements of the 18th and 19th centuries, and upon an expanding and progressive capitalist economy, has enabled the ruling classes to obtain the support, or at least the grudging tolerance, of the middle and the working classes. Now, it's interesting to contrast Thomas Jefferson, the architect of the Democratic Creed, with John Dewey, the last brilliant spokesman of it. Jefferson believed that democracy could not be secure unless it rested upon an extensive class of small landed proprietors. He coupled the decentralization of political power in the hands of a broad class with the wide dispersal of property ownership in the hands of the people. He viewed the two as going hand in hand. And he said, wherever property is centralized in the hands of a few, there is bound to be a lack of democracy and the presence of autocracy in government. Now, in Dewey's time, property ownership and political power had both become highly centralized. How then, in the terms of Jeffersonian democracy, was this form of government to be saved and strengthened? Dewey's answer is this: we can no longer rely upon a dispersion of property. What we must rely upon is a dispersion of goodwill, of progressive ideas. And he called upon men and women of goodwill drawn from every station of American life. And these would come together as liberal-minded citizens and act unitedly to establish a classless society. a purified democracy. No single class will lead the way. He didn't think this was realistic. He believed that a better democracy ought to be built and could be built. But the way to such a classless democracy was through a classless movement. Now, we don't believe that. We are in favor of a classless society. But we think it can come into being only on the basis of a new and higher economic foundation, which can come about only by taking the means of production out of the hands of the monopolists and nationalize them. And what kind of force is there in our society that can carry through such an assignment? In our opinion, only the organized working class. In fact, the creation of a classless democracy is an historical possibility and a theoretical absurdity. I'm not talking now about a classless society. I'm talking about a classless democracy. Because democracy means essentially the rule of the majority over the minority, and it involves basically the existence of a state power, which is an instrument of coercion against one or another section of the people. When you really get a classless society, there'll be no place or function for any form of a state, whether it's democratic, autocratic, monarchical, tyrannical, or what have you. That's why a classless democracy as such is an historical impossibility. But that's not our problem today. We don't have to be debating too much about that. The pressing problem of our political life is not how to effect a transition from classless rule to a classless democracy, but rather how to build a bridge, make the transition from the decaying and the narrowing democracy of the bourgeois order to a workers' democracy based upon a nationalized and a planned economy. And the main agency for accomplishing this changeover is the independent organization and revolutionary action of the working class, whether they're black or white, and not a motley coalition of good-hearted and liberal-minded individuals drawn from all classes, even if it is baptized under the name of an anti-monopoly coalition. The final point I want now to make goes back to my first point. And you may not have ever thought about this. I've said that one of the major sources of bourgeois democratic ideology is Christianity. And we see that the notion of a classless democracy is essentially a secularized offspring of Christian teachings on equality. And that's why the ideas of John Dewey can be and often are delivered from a pulpit as well as from the rostrum of a university. That's why they are very much in order, for example, in a Unitarian church. Now, what did the Christian Gospels teach? They teach that all men, regardless of their social status, are the same in the sight of God. This religious equality of the slave and the slave owner, the rich and the poor, the oppressor and the oppressed, is viciously fictitious. It offers consolation to the lowly in a life after death, while in earthly reality, the slave remains a chattel, the poor go hungry, and the humble, however exalted in the hereafter, continue to suffer degradation during their lifetime. The advocates of bourgeois democracy, who are saturated in the Christian tradition, translate this mystical promise of equality into prosaic legal and political terms by means of the theory of natural law. According to this theory, by the decree of nature or reason, or the fact that nature is reasonable, or reason exemplifies itself in nature, say that all men are to be considered equal before the law, and should have equal voice and vote in deciding the destiny of their country and their community. As Anatole France said, both the rich and the poor have an equal right to sleep under the bridge, and when they're arrested, an equal right to plead innocent or guilty before the judge. Now, this theory of natural rights entered into the thought of the American people as a heritage from the English Revolution and the declarations of our founding fathers. According to it, every citizen has equal rights in religion, in the courts, in politics, and an equal chance to engage in trade and economic competition. Such is the theory. But what has been the reality? This type of democracy rests on the fiction that the real inequality of social conditions does not decisively affect the ideal equality of civic and legal rights. But this bourgeois democracy had more substantial support in its defense of the absolute rights of private property. And so it was that the working class rose up against this formal bourgeois democracy, which gave equal rights in theory, but denied them in practice, in demanding the real fulfillment of democratic principles and promises. And so, democracy, counterposed to the rule of the rich, found its next and its rounded formulation in the program of socialism. And next time, I want to tell more about the reality of democracy under the monopoly capitalism of the United States. Yeah, that will be the concluding lecture of this series. I'm going to talk about socialist democracy in theory and in practice. Yes.
How and where did Dewey differ from Husky and with his earlier teachers? Is it simply in American
uniqueness? How did Dewey differ from Kautsky? Well, no, there was a great difference in the starting points and the doctrines of the two thinkers. After all, Karl Kautsky was an orthodox Marxist who, when it came to the test of the Russian Revolution, turned more conservative than his original teachings warranted. Dewey, although now and then he inclined toward the ideas of socialism, was essentially a liberal. However, they did have a coincidence of thinking in that they exalted generalized principles above the imperatives and the realities of the class struggle, but within a different ideological framework and as leaders of different social and political